The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
Spaceship Earth on a journey we know not where, with fuel to last we don't know for how long. The route we're taking we're not sure of. Why we're aboard is unclear. How long we're going to stay here is unknown. Whether we'll run out of fuel short of the destination has never occurred to us. Why we have only 6% first-class passengers and the rest are tagging along in third class is rather a ridiculous disparity between those who are experiencing all the affluence and those who wish they could. But what is the trip all about? Every morning you wake up, you've traveled approximately 8,000 miles from where you closed your eyes, stared at your brains, went to sleep. Begin to take deep breathing exercises all night long. Your body, if you've eaten correctly, exercised correctly, which is true in a tiny little smattering of a handful of cases, as far as the whole human populace is concerned, is busily, for those 8 hours approximately, rejuvenating itself. Your blood corpuscles are busily carrying, like little plates and discs, you know, they described way back in high school to you, all these little bits of food and things you've ingested to all the parts of your body. And you wake up in the morning and you don't get up and say thanks to the Creator for keeping you alive. You don't get down and worship gravity for keeping you there when you were on a world that was turning completely around to face the sun again for the rising of the day. If you live, and bless you if you do, it's a remarkable and a wonderful thing to live where you can hear a rooster crow. I hear sirens blow. There's a difference, you know. Not precisely at 6 or 6:30, but just all through the day and the night. But you've taken quite a trip when that rooster begins to see the gray light of dawn and begins to stir around the hens a little bit in the morning. You've been going for about 8,000 miles. You've been completely upside down. The pull of gravity, the effect of the moon, the operation of the solar system, the whole of the universe, what's going on in the world beneath your feet, the air you've been breathing, the automatic action of your heart, the subconscious, automatic when you're asleep, controllable when you're awake, action of your lungs has been going on, your bloodstream has been pumping away because of that fantastic muscle in there. How'd that all get started? Did that come from algae, amoeba, and frogs? Did that come from salamanders, amphibians, and reptiles? Did it come from former kind of shellfish or mollusks or little amoebic dysentery? No, that's something else. What did it come from? How did we get to be here? What is this trip all about? You're alive. Now, don't ask me to go to a biology textbook. I got this desk looking like a science classroom here just to get a few quotations to tell you about today, to tell you what life is all about. They can't tell you. They don't know what life is. This is a book about life. It's a book about you and about me. It's called Biological Science by William T. Keaton, Cornell University. Now, this is a textbook, a slick textbook. It costs about $10, $9.95. It's from 1967. It's carried by many college students, I'm sure, even today. I asked for some of the most up-to-the-moment biological textbooks on this subject of science, and which give you this subtle inference throughout that we are the result of evolution. And therefore, science can give us no purpose in our being alive on the earth. It cannot tell us what this mysterious journey is all about. What is its destination? Why we're going there? It can't tell us really what we are. It chooses not to try because it admits at the very outset, and I don't speak of all scientists, I'm speaking of those who are quoted in books such as these. I'm speaking basically of evolutionary science because there is a great deal of difference between some scientists who do use scientific methods, who measure, who observe, who weigh, who collect data, who theorize and speculate and postulate, who try to prove those theories and decide whether or not they are admissible as real fact or whether they can be called law. People who wear the label of science, I suppose, as much as the characters that you read of, and they warn you against these in nearly all college textbooks of the characters in the starched white uniforms and that are puzzling over the wings of a fly or maybe chasing a butterfly off over a hill. I've seen time and again in many scientific textbooks that what the comics and what television and what novels have done to scientists is resented by many serious-minded scientists. They don't like the idea of being called four-eyed wonders or people that are bent over laboratories and are very narrow and specialized. They rather insistently, in the opening introductory material of many of these textbooks, tell you that scientists are not like that. They're just like other people. Fine, I'm willing to agree that scientists are just like other people. I've never met any of those types in starched white uniforms bending over flies in laboratories, but I've seen a lot of quotations from people that did make you wonder, and I'm going to show you a few like that. So here we are on this beautiful spaceship Earth, billions of us. Every single year, the nation of China is adding enough individuals to make more than the sufficient population to add another Australia. Every year, India adds enough babies, in spite of the enormous death rate of these nations, in spite of infant mortality, in spite of horrible malnutrition and starvation, India adds enough to people a nation like Canada. Every 39 days, the world adds a population equivalent to a New York City. We don't know why so many tens of thousands are dying. We don't know why so many millions are being born. We don't know why we're on the earth, yet science seeks to know. The word science means knowledge. Years and years ago, the Apostle Paul, a man who really did live, wrote to a young man whose name was Timothy, and he warned him about oppositions of what he called science, falsely so-called. I'm going to turn to that. It's over in 1 Timothy, the 6th chapter. I'll have to turn to it. Take just a second to get there. He had said for Timothy to hold fast that which he was taught. In verse 20 of that 6th chapter of 1 Timothy, it said, O Timothy, keep that which is committed to your trust, avoiding profane. That means really earthy. It doesn't mean cuss words, by the way. Really, historically, the word profane means other than divinely revealed. It means other than spiritual. Profane meaning just earthy, worldly, carnal, average, natural, commonplace, and vain babblings and oppositions of science, falsely so-called. So here's a place in the Bible where the word science is used, but it doesn't take issue with true science. It implies, by the very statement of science falsely so-called, that there is science which is correctly so-called. Oh, sure there is. There's knowledge. There is scientific knowledge. And true science, the scientific method, is not in contradiction whatsoever to the Bible, the Word of God. And this is the thing that I'd like to reveal to you and get you to understand. Let me show you then the subtle insistence that there is no God, the subtle, continual insistence that evolution did take place, and how it is that even when they begin to introduce you to how Darwin came up with the original theory that young, impressionable college students going by the hundreds of thousands in the big universities of today, having already been exposed to evolution through all their grade and high school years, are continually, insistently, repetitiously taught that there is no other alternative to evolution. In the beginning introduction material to these organizations, I was going to say these books, they tell you a great deal about what you're going to find therein. So I'm talking about the introduction now of a modern $10 heavy textbook on biology. It tells you the subject of the book is biological science, the study of life. But what is life? First question in the book, first line, first paragraph. We have some intuitive idea. After all, we have life. And many of the things with which we come in contact every day has life. But when asked to say explicitly what life is, few of us can give a satisfying answer. Actually, the Supreme Court can't even give an answer. They passed a law not long ago about whether or not the body was dead when the brain died or the heart died. And that begins to worry me a little bit. There's people walking around, you can suspect with a stethoscope, their brain is dead. And, you know, it reminded me of the Life magazine series. The poor guy had a collision with the trunk of an oak tree in his bicycle. They rushed up, put a stethoscope on him, and said his brain was dead. Carved open his chest, took out his heart, tossed it to the guy in a wagon who jumped in and stuck it in some kind of a solution, went screaming around the corner, and promptly transplanted it into somebody else. Actually, at the very close of one of these books, it talks about controlled genetics and the big real problems confronting all of humankind today of the population explosion and when we're going to face these moral issues, the economic and the social, the racial issues about who is going to decide whether to alter the human body, whether to virtually recreate portions of humanity, and so on. You know that there is somebody going into the commercial business now of accepting people who die from diseases for deep freeze storage
at a fee, so that at some time when science presumably learns how to unfreeze them and bring them back to life, they can be all labeled with a tag hanging on the big toe and come back to life, and they're going to take money from them and their relatives to do it? Seems to me like church organizations ought to get into that act. What am I saying? They already have. Now, if the morticians and the church people would get together, you could really, and even the military in some nations, they could all get together, they could really make a racket out of this business. They could have spaceship-designed coffins, they could sell all kinds of short journeys, and, you know, all the way past Mars, wherever. Or they could have asbestos-lined boxes. You think you're going to the other place. There are times I have heard of when people were buying waterproof coffins. They just couldn't stand the idea of their body liner getting wet. Now today, because of the high cost of dying, a subject I would like to do a series on sometime, people are increasingly having their bodies incinerated and the ashes scattered out at sea. What is life? Where do we go when we die? Is there any reason to bother with trying to preserve a body? Does it matter whether you're burnt or frozen? Is there any life after death? Can science answer? No, science says we can't answer that. We don't know. Well, fine. Then why does science try to answer it by telling you there is no God and you've got to accept that we're all evolutionary creatures and we came from simple forms of life? I'll show you how it tries to define life and yet tells you by the time you get through trying to define it that you will not be able to answer the question, what is life, convincingly after you've read a book this thick. I don't know how many dozen chapters. Fantastic book. Oh, and it gets wordy. And they tell you, they assure you after you're through with this course, go to college for a whole year and take this course. You won't know how to answer anybody who comes up and says, what's life? Makes you wonder, why take the course?
From the dawn of history, man has sought to understand the forces that act around him. Ancient philosophers visualized every different power as a separate god. In this modern age of laser beams and space technology, we understand how to use these forces, but we still don't know how they came into being. What should we be able to learn from the existence of matter, energy, force, and inertia? Does God exist? Is a free booklet that dares to look at our world, God, and science objectively. Does God exist? Uses the tools of modern technology to prove how the laws and forces acting upon us every day clearly demonstrate the existence of God. From the dawn of history, man has sought to understand. Now you can know. Request, does God exist? Send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.
You know, when you begin to read these books, you get a kind of a taste in your mouth. I do. They laud, they praise, they congratulate, they really say hooray for science. They show you how beautiful, how wonderful, how fundamental, how honest, how accurate, how enormous, how intelligent is science. You want to say, yay, science. It says right here the point about the spirit of science. Point one, the spirit of science is, at bottom, a longing to understand. It seeks to understand because it accepts knowledge as desirable in itself. What would you think of a guy who was standing there and someone said, take a look at this. And he's got his back to it. He says, oh, I want to see it so badly. I long to see that and understand it. Well, turn around and look at it. I'm sorry. I've already been, it reminds me of Zeke, you know. He's got his feet propped in the windowsill. His chair's the other way, chewing on a wheat stalk. And Ebenezer says, Zeke, there goes Squire Jones' funeral procession down in the valley. Reckon it's the longest ever held in these parts. He says, yep, I sure would have liked to have seen it. Too bad my chair's turned the other way. You know, sometimes you wonder, here's the Bible which says, prove me now herewith. And it says in the first chapter of the book of Romans, in the writing of the Apostle Paul, that which may be known of God is evident to them, for God has shown it to them, for from the creation of the world, looking at that which is created, the divine, unseen things of God are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Now, the Bible talks about the universe, the earth, the material creation, but it also gives the answers as to how the forces, the laws, and the energies that act upon the material creation came into existence, and how the great divine architect of the universe brought it into existence, and true science and the Bible do not contradict each other. There is room in the book of Genesis for an indeterminate period of billions of years. There can be buryings and unearthings of the continental masses of the world as many times as science would like. The Bible admits for as many floods, as many avalanches of roaring tidal waves over the surface of the land masses of this earth as science would like. The point is that way back when the great big struggle began with Darwin's published theory, and then all the years when many of the church bodies began to look at this as a threat to their existence, and people then began to think that the world was only exactly 6,000 years of age, God had created everything, including the rocks, just the way they were, which is stupid. It really is. But then, you know, look at the poor guy. Was it Galileo who began to explode the myth that the earth is the center of the universe and everything revolves around the earth, and then a church type. Is it okay to identify which one? Well, no, I won't do that. Anyhow, they got this guy in front of a whole group of people that were wearing the uniform. You know, God looking around. Anybody uniform down there today? Oh, there they are. And so here were these people in uniform, and they had poor old Galileo. He was a scientist down there, and they forced him, I guess under pain and threat of death, to say, no, it doesn't move. It just stands there still. Now, he knew that the world, he discovered that the world was turning, and that the world was taking an annual trip around the sun. That exploded their idea, which was basically just vanity, that they wanted to be the center of the universe. Now, he was heard, you know, when he got up to mutter under his breath, you've heard the story before, it moves nevertheless. He said, okay, it doesn't move. I give up. You got me. You know, the point of a bayonet usually does change people's minds. They say, I'll accept anything. That's why I said sometimes, this thing of the immortality of the soul carried to its ultimate extreme, you could envision the preacher preaching, the believers coming to the baptismal font, and the firing squad sending to heaven. That scares the daylights out of me. It's about time that somebody got a little bit hysterical about some of these doctrines and these ideas that masquerade as theology, which cannot be demonstrated in the Bible. So here's a book on the biological sciences, and it says at the beginning, no need to get disturbed. Now you're going to study the course for a year, and you still won't be able to tell anybody what he's like. So it says, so marvelous in its complexity is life, so constantly changing. This entire book is about life, yet when you have finished it, you still won't be able to define life convincingly. It talks about the need to know is sufficient motivation in itself. Science, it says, is concerned with a material universe. Then it goes on and says, science cannot deal with anything that cannot be observed. Well, evolution cannot be observed. The missing intermediate species. The whole chain is missing. They got a couple of links. It goes on to show you what is a good scientist and what is a bad scientist. Now, you've heard of a good doctor and a bad doctor. You never go to the bad doctors. I don't even know where they are. You don't see the signs. This is a bad doctor. Stay away. But you don't find bad scientists and good scientists except in courtroom suits, I guess. The same comment for doctors. But it shows here what a good scientist is like. Any good scientist, it says, page 3 of the introductory material of this book, must be ready to alter or even abandon his most cherished generalizations when new facts contradict them. Now, the last couple of times I was talking about the coal beds of the Rocky Mountains and the Appalachians and the entirety of the United States of America and all around the world, and how they know and they can prove to you that the trunks of big trees, the pines and other types, tropical vegetation, huge fronds and leaves down to tiny little pieces of moss and delicate ferns, all made up coal beds. How they were buried suddenly, how it takes from 5 to 8 feet of that vegetable material to create 1 foot thickness of coal. Not the anthracite necessarily either, but just the regular bituminous coal, a softer coal that we use for fuel today. And therefore, when you got a 20-foot thick seam of coal, you're dealing with something which might have been as much as 160 feet thick of vegetation that was then buried, and buried suddenly over a period of many miles sometimes those coal seams go. Had the opportunity a few months back to wander around in a little corner of Colorado and to go into some of these ancient old abandoned coal mines. Little coal cars still back there. Really eerie, you know. But here was this fantastic area. There had been a city there, wandering all down through this one valley near a town called Ludlow, where there is a National Mine Workers Monument. I believe the Colorado State Militia was called out. Something like about 1912, there was a massacre of men, women, and children there. And those coal mines were closed down because the cost of getting the coal out became, it's an old story, too much when divided by the amount of profit that could be derived from it. So coal mining is something that is a necessity for our modern technological age. And coal and the deposits that made our coal beds are a major proof there had to be vast catastrophes and inundations in the past. And that does not substantiate an evolutionary theory, but it does substantiate instant creation and then great cataclysms from time to time.
Wouldn't it be nice to buy just one gift of the whole family?
Many doctors recommend. For further information on buying and selling gold, consult any bank.
And it's absolutely free.
The human mind is constantly bombarded with ideas. Some good, some bad.
Hearings were scheduled to conclude today.
The opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent.
The law requires a substantial interest.
All you got to do is buy two.
You're responsible for making the right choices.
Reasonable prices.
Point where prohibited by law.
No purchase necessary.
Plain Truth helps you unjangle the conflict of ideas in our over-communicated world. This monthly publication offers straightforward insight and understanding. Proving which ideas in this world are valuable and which are not is your responsibility. Plain Truth can help. Request your subscription today. There's no cost or obligation. Plain Truth.
Send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. That's Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.
Any good scientist, it says, must be able to abandon the most cherished of his generalizations if new facts or data force them to be altered or abandoned. When you go out and find and collect and observe material, factual data. And I say that coal is certain of that. I mean, it's so factual you can get dirty just handling the stuff. And you can see with your own eyes. You don't need to be a specialist or a geologist to see the imprint of a fern or a palm frond or something. You can see that that is fossil life, and you know by looking at it, it did not decompose. That it was buried alive, buried suddenly, or it simply didn't get preserved, but it was preserved. So you know that it was buried alive. Yet, the theory of uniformitarianism and the attempted explanation of how coal beds were formed is so ludicrous, even in looking into some of the encyclopedias, it contradicts itself in the same article. It tries to give you the idea of this primordial swamp, all this wonderful, luxurious vegetable material. It dies. It said right there in the text, I read it to you last time, this big old tree goes plop in the swamp. And then it decays, and new life grows upon it, and then that dies. Now, already they've contradicted themselves. How? Well, because coal proves that a great deal of it, and I say all of it, basically, with the exception of some very soft coal in the peat areas, which is basically not even commercially, obtainable, because there's much other material mixed in with it, like, well, fire clays and sand and all this other stuff, that it's hard to get it out. But at any rate, the real harder coal, which was compressed vegetable material, real good pure stuff, where there's a big thick vein of it that is mined today, or even strip mined on the surface, that was laid down suddenly. That was buried suddenly. That wasn't the gradual decomposition that takes place in swampy marshes. Now, you've heard about marsh gas. You've heard about swamps. You've smelled swamps. You've been around swamps, maybe, especially if you live in Louisiana or Florida, and I'm here to tell you swamp stink. That humidity, the decaying vegetation. I remember so well how disappointed I was one time. I went to a little Florida stream on the west coast of Florida, and I was going to go fishing, and there'd come one of these hurricanes through on the other side or something, and it raised the water table, and a lot of this brackish water from swamps had been flowing into the fresh water, and so all the fish were killed. And here were fish floating by, belly up, this swamp water, the decaying brackish water, where all of this vegetable material is just, you know, making a kind of a chemical soup out of this water, had gotten over into the fresh water and kills all the fish. So,
every single time I see these scientific textbooks trying to insistently continue to put across the idea of evolution, of uniformitarianism, of gradual aeons of slow change, and then I look at the rocks under my feet, I look at the coal beds, I look at the giant granitic upthrusts of the mountain ranges of the United States,
I look at some of the so-called sedimentary strata, which really is water-borne, water deposited that have been folded and twisted, and that is sometimes captured in certain pools where all these decaying bodies that were buried alive have collected. And these form oil wells. And I see, again, burials. We look at Dinosaur National Monument. We look at fossil life. People have been brainwashed to think that they are faced with two alternatives. Either they say, I believe in the Bible, and therefore they can't believe in fossil men, or fossil animals, or fossil vegetation. They can't believe in the world being older than 6,000 years, or they've got to say, I believe in science and reject the Bible. And that's wrong. True science. I don't care how old they say the world is. If they say 4.5 billion years and they think that's fairly accurate, I could agree with them. If they want 20 billion years, that's fine. The Bible does not contradict that. The Bible shows in the very first two verses of Genesis 1 that the Spirit of God was brooding over the face of the deep. It shows the continents of this earth buried under water. It says, let the dry land appear. It shows the raising of the continents. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to go out here sometime to a stream bed, and we'll have to think about this. Maybe we can do it sometime. Photograph and experiment. We'll just take a flat piece of metal, but all kinds of clay and sand and all kinds of constituents, just like you'd find out here in the surface of the earth somewhere, and make it nice and smooth, and then just slowly submerge it under this stream, and then just raise it up all of a sudden and hold it there, and let the water drain off, and then look at it closely and see what we would have. And we would have mountain ranges and valleys and drainage patterns. We would have pools here and there, dry lake beds. We would have a topographical picture just about exactly the way you find the surface of this earth. And that was a catastrophe when that occurred. You can look at some of the faulting, the giant earthquakes of yesteryear that caused the formation of our mountains, and you can't for 1 minute believe in the theory that everything is going along in some gradual, normal, eroding process. Your own eyes, whether they are skilled and intellectually superior eyes, whether they are eyes that have gone through 10 geology, astronomy, biology textbooks or not, whether you have a degree from some university where you got all sorts of evolutionary ideas or not, your eyes tell you that the rocks under your feet were subjected at some time in the past to a giant catastrophe. That's all there is to it. There's no question about it. Well, I'll come back next time and go in a little more thoroughly to this thing of the spirit of science. And I have a few quotations for you out of a Bible help, which is called a Bible commentary. You might be surprised about that, because it shows very plainly that you can believe in what the Bible says and still accept anything that is really proved about science. It's when science speculates that I take exception to it. And next time I'll show you a few of those speculations. Meantime, write for this booklet, Does God Exist? And also, while you're at it, be sure to write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, a family magazine dealing with the big issues, the big problems, the ones that confront us every single day. The food on your table, the shirt and the clothing on your back, your own financial well-being, your job, your home, your school, your church, your family. Big issues of the day that are talked about by politicians. Some of the moral decadence in our countries and societies. Articles along these and other lines, and giving you the solutions from the point of view of the Word of God. The Plain Truth Magazine, free of charge, no price. All you need to do is to send your request to me, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, and we'll send it to you by return mail free of charge. Now, articles just like this plain talk, will be coming along in the Plain Truth Magazine just about every single issue. You can have that kind of copy if you'll write for the Plain Truth. It's free of charge. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong, goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.